Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasing refugee tragedies in the Mediterranean, where 10,000 immigrants have been rescued in recent days, with more than 500 drowned, including a hideous incident in which Muslims tossed Christians overboard. Daryl Krusgraber, who leads Refugee International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, joins us to discuss divisions in the EU over how to respond to the refugee crisis, which the Pope has warned is turning the Mediterranean into a vast cemetery. Then, with the Republican House passing the so-called Death Tax Repeal Act of 2015 that will exempt America's richest families from estate taxes and allow them to pass on their wealth from generation to generation without ever being taxed, we will speak with Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University and the author of Oligarchy. We will discuss the power of America's elite to escape taxes and the political strategy to pass the burden down to the middle class and working Americans, thus making those who are unfairly taxed more angry at taxes than at the 1% who are avoiding paying their fair share. Then finally, we'll examine the bill to limit vaccine exemptions of school children that is stalled in the California legislature between the Senate Health Committee and the Senate Education Committee, following vocal demonstrations from the anti-vaxxers who don't want to vaccinate their kids but want them to get a public education where they pose a danger to their classmates. Dr. Peter Katona, a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine and a professor of public health at UCLA, joins us to discuss whether a special school for the children of those with unconventional belief systems is a viable option. And joining us now is Daryl Krusgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Krusgraber.
Thank you for having me.
And there's been an extraordinary number of drownings in the Mediterranean, particularly with refugees coming from North Africa. Almost 10,000 migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean have been rescued in recent days. And the most extraordinary incident just took place where Italian police have arrested 15 Muslim migrants after they allegedly threw 12 Christian migrants overboard. The migrants that were thrown overboard and presumably drowned were from Ghana and Nigeria. And the Italian police arrested the Muslim suspects who were from the Ivory Coast, Senegal, Mali, and Guinea. So, I mean, it's such a grim story, and of course, this is just an extra grim layer to that story. So, what do you make of this increasing human tragedy?
Yeah. Well, first, I think the huge numbers that we're talking about, as you said, 10,000 in the past week, I think only, is an indication of just how desperate people really are. So, and of course, I cover Syria, but it's not just the Syrians who are being displaced. There are people who are migrating because they're refugees. There are people who are migrating because they need jobs. There are people who are migrating because they want to join family. And so the places that people are leaving from tend to be along the coast of North Africa, and I think the conditions there and the ability of people to live in those places is quite desperate in many cases. And so that's why we keep seeing these increasing numbers of people leaving and then having tragedies at sea, because they want to get out of where they are. And if there's better humanitarian refugee response in some of these countries for the refugee populations, we might be seeing a little bit less of these drownings at sea.
Well, apparently last year, a record 170,000 people fleeing poverty and conflicts in Africa and the Middle East made these perilous journeys to Italy. That's an extraordinary number of people.
Yeah, it really is. And over 3,000 of them died in the attempt. And I think that, again, is an indication of just how desperate people are. Rather than, say, going to the next country over or staying put where they are in refuge from conflict, for example, they're choosing to move on because they so desperately want something more.
But it's pretty hard to believe that refugees from Africa, from West Africa, make that incredibly perilous journey all the way up, and then they go through Libya, which is a country in the midst of a civil war. And these refugees that were just drowned in the last week or so all set out from Libya in rubber boats, many of which capsized. And in the case of the ones where the Muslims tossed the Christians overboard, that was also another rubber boat. But I'm astounded that they could even get that far and cross all of Libya, which is a big country and a vast desert, that's a country that's in the midst of a civil war. These have got to be tales of enormous human endurance, not to mention tragedy.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And what comes to mind for me is when I was in Egypt in 2014, we talked to quite a lot of Syrian refugees who had tried to cross the Mediterranean, leaving from the north coast of Egypt. Many of them had been intercepted by Egyptian authorities and sent back. And when we spoke to them, they said, "We're going to do this again," because that is how anxious people are to move on from where they are. People who are migrating and who really feel that they have no better choices are incredibly resourceful and resilient in making these journeys. And so people, for example, the Syrians in Egypt were also, where they were turned back in Egypt, were going into Libya as well and trying to leave from the Libyan coast instead. One thing to keep in mind is that part of how this happens is through smuggling networks as well, right? So you might not find, your average person sort of trotting from Egypt into Libya and getting on a boat, but there are smuggling networks that exist for which people pay a very high price, as you might guess, because they think it's more likely that they're going to make it there if they have one of these, I guess you'd call it a structured system for getting across the ocean. So that is what a lot of people are working to get to just in order to arrive in Libya. And from there, they have a smuggling network that takes them across, and they're hoping for the best.
And again, I'm speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. So given that more than 3,000 people have died in the Mediterranean Sea last year, which has prompted Pope Francis to say that the waters are in danger of becoming a vast cemetery, the Italian government is asking the European Union for more help, for more financial help, and more money from the 28 member states. But only 22 of the members are supporting the current system, and a number of other European states, including the United Kingdom, have opted out of this program, describing the Italian policy as unintentionally encouraging more migrants attempting to make these hazardous crossings. So walk us through the politics, if you can, Daryl.
Yeah, sure. So you'll probably remember that last year, it started in 2013 and went through most of 2014, there was an Italian Navy operation called Mare Nostrum, and it was very specifically a search and rescue mission for these migrants who are coming primarily from the north coast of Africa, but some further flung originations as well. And the idea was to make sure that people were not dying at sea and trying to make this crossing. Often when people were saved, they were put into detention when they got to Italy most often. And there were a lot of issues with whether or not they could get out of detention, move on further to join family members in other parts of Europe. That operation was suspended toward the end of last year. And so now, instead, there is this operation called Triton, I think. Trident, something like that. Sorry.
Yeah. Triton.
And it Triton. Thank you. And it is meant to be more of a wider EU cooperative mission. But the issue here is that it's not as focused on saving lives as it is on controlling the borders. And this is tricky in a couple of ways, because number one, if you're looking at controlling the borders and keeping people out, that almost certainly means that there will be more deaths at sea, because saving lives is not the focus. And part of how that came about is that if saving lives is in fact the focus, there are a number of countries in the EU that believe that this will be a pull factor for migrants. So we can get on a boat, even a rickety boat, even a terrible boat that might sink. We can risk our lives, but, you know, we will be saved by Europe. And so more and more of them will try to do that, not thinking like, oh, well, we might die and there will be no one to help us. So the UK, for example, it fears that that is a pull factor and so doesn't want to be involved. But it's unfortunate because right now the current policy is much more focused on border control. And so I think already they're taking a step back from saving lives. And the bottom line is none of this is a pull factor in the sense that people are going to keep crossing the Mediterranean no matter what. Because if they perceive that there's a better chance for them in Europe, they will keep making these attempts. Whether or not they're rescued, you know, in a sinking ship is probably not factoring into their decisions a whole lot. And so if the focus is moved away from saving lives, there will almost certainly be more deaths because the same number of people and possibly even more are going to keep trying regardless.
And what is the distinction then between genuine refugees who are escaping political persecution, which would certainly be the case in Syria, where there's a civil war and extraordinary violence? But my understanding that most of the immigrants coming from North Africa are economic refugees, if you will. They're looking for a better life. So how do you make that distinction in terms of humanitarian outreach?
It's a great question because it's a difficult distinction to make. So, I mean, people who are refugees, it can be a little bit easier to determine because they are fleeing persecution. And there is a, you know, there's a definition in international human rights law about what it means to be a refugee. But for people who are, for example, leaving to seek better economic opportunities, they may be doing that because they are also, in fact, fleeing a refugee-like situation, but they have approached it in a different way. So they may, for example, not be able to get a job somewhere because of the political opinion they hold, but instead of waiting to be actually persecuted for that, they've proactively moved on and are looking for a life somewhere else. So, in fact, it's extremely hard to distinguish who is who within these mixed migration flows, which is what we call it when it's, you know, not just refugees or just economic migrants moving in one place. It's very hard to distinguish who's who. And the fact is that in 2015, there's a tremendous amount of overlap in those things as well.
Well, it seems that the only winners in this are these people smugglers, and some of them seem extraordinarily callous. They pack hundreds of migrants into the very unseaworthy boats and send them off into the face of winter storms in the Mediterranean. Others have apparently, and there have been incidents where a freighter was packed full of people and it was put on autopilot and it crashed into the, or I think it was intercepted before it crashed into the Italian coast.
Yeah.
Some of the smugglers now are getting a little more sophisticated. They're sending people, smaller groups of people aboard yachts in the Mediterranean, which are probably much less detectable. And now, of course, the weather is a lot better. But my understanding is that we're talking about between 7,000 and 8,000 euros per head. Is that the going rate?
Sounds about right. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what that is in dollars, but anywhere between $3,000 and $5,000 is what we generally hear. The smuggling, make no mistake, is a big business and it's a lucrative business. And part of the reason that it's so hard to break up these smuggling rings is that they very much involve local people at what we might consider a kind of a ground level. So you might have a local fisherman in Libya, for example, who on the side also, you know, indicates people for migration or secures a small boat to put a bunch of people on. And so it's, when it gets down to the ground level, it's a little bit less formalized and structured than you might look at for, say, organized crime or something like that. And so it's really very hard to find out who's involved and to break up these smuggling rings. In addition, the people at that level on the ground who are involved are often just local people who need to make a little bit of extra money on the side because they're probably not in very different situations from these migrants themselves. And so it becomes quite difficult to systematically find each person who's involved in this and have any sort of prosecution, I suppose, or even just, you know, finding out who's doing what.
But Darrell Grisgraber, you lead Refugee International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, and you focus mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. And I imagine that the route is, since so many Syrians escaping the civil war go into Turkey, a lot also go into Jordan, where they're essentially stuck in the desert in these vast camps, and a lot also go into Lebanon. But I imagine those that go into Turkey make the route across to the nearby Mediterranean, then on to Europe. So is that the main channel? And if so, what's going on with the Turkish authorities in terms of cooperation?
I think it is one of the main routes. I'd say Turkey to Europe, parts of Egypt to Europe, and then Libya to Europe are probably all sort of about equally used routes. And for example, in Egypt, the authorities have gotten much more proactive about turning back boats and perhaps detaining people for illegal departure, that sort of thing. In Turkey, it's been a little bit harder to pin down because, as you mentioned earlier, there were people buying these giant freighters who were no longer seaworthy, packing them full of people and just sending them out there with no one on board to really guide things. And so I think the Turkish authorities are certainly extremely capable of intercepting boats like this and turning them back, but they have been a little bit less proactive in doing that right now because it's new-ish that the Syrians, for example, have been departing from Turkey. But I have to expect in the next probably 6 months that is very much going to start happening, particularly if the EU is looking at this issue as a border protection issue. They're going to have to bring Turkey in to nip it in the bud, so to speak.
But it seems, though, that that this phenomenon of people smuggling and migration from the Third World into Europe is something that's probably going to continue, right, if not increase, unless there's more stability. And obviously, Libya is a complete mess. Syria is a complete mess. Yep. I mean, it is such a tragedy that mafia family that runs Syria consider their own privileges to be rule indefinitely, have this family rule indefinitely, that the whole country has to pay a price. And there's also, of course, a lot of the displacement and anger that led to the Syrian revolution was to do with the effects of global warming and on agriculture, etc. So there are lots of factors at play here, you know, global warming being among them. So how do you come up with a regime that is fair in between, you know, that somehow can mediate between the haves and the have-nots, people who come from failed states that want to have a better life, and then people in these European states who are basically saying, you know, enough already, you know, we're already overtaxed and overstretched to begin with?
I think that's a question that no one really has an answer to, but I would say, you know, a way to start addressing that is to find ways of regulating migration so that people do not have to move to other countries in these ways that endanger their lives. And also work within the sending countries, the countries of origin, that really allows people more meaningful access to their own human rights would probably stop as many people from migrating out of desperation in the first place. And so I think, you know, kind of a global, a global agenda to kind of empower people, I guess, and to eradicate poverty is probably a good start to that.
Well, that's a big, heavy lift, isn't it? And one that's been going on for some time. So what do you think, just in terms of the immediate political battle going on within the EU itself, with a lot, you know, a number of the European nations saying that they don't want to support the Italian effort because they believe it actually encourages this hazardous emigration from North Africa and the Middle East?
Yes. Right now, if the EU as a whole is going to claim that it is committed to human rights and to saving lives in these situations, then some of the member states who are not backing Operation Triton, for example, and some of the states who are but could have some more robust input, need to really step up and put their money where their mouth is there and focus at least as much on saving lives as they are on controlling their borders.
Well, Darrell Grisgraber, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Republican House's passage of the so-called Death Tax Repeal Act of 2015. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He also studies state-capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank, human rights, authoritarianism, and democratic transitions in post-colonial states. He's the author of Oligarchy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's good to be back.
And today, the House of Representatives passed the so-called Death Tax Repeal Act of 2015, a bill that would end nearly 100 years of federal estate taxes. The legislation passed 239 to 179. It's a fairly extraordinary thing that this could be happening, because it will be, it probably won't pass the Senate, and it certainly will be vetoed by the president. So why are the House Republicans going out on a limb for America's 2% of the 1%.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, one of the things we're seeing here is this is an expression of wealth power in the United States. So it's useful to think of two kinds of power that exist in our system right now. One we might call participation power. That is, each of us gets one vote, and that's very equal. And then there is wealth power. And that is distributed very unequally. And both of those kinds of power operate in the American system. So if you have hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars, that's money that you can use. Those are resources you can use directly to lobby, to fund candidates, even to launch presidential candidates on your own if you're rich enough. So it's an agenda which is responding to the smallest, tiniest percentage of the interests of the ultra-wealthy in the United States. And it's really leaving sort of 998 out of 1,000 holding the bag.
Well, not only does it exempt the super-rich, the richest American families from estate taxes, because already the ceiling is about 4.5 million for regular folks. So this canard that the Republicans have been floating for the longest time about the so-called death tax, that it destroys family farms and stuff, is complete nonsense. Because for an individual, it's the exemption is 5.4 million, and for a couple, it's about 11 million. So most people don't get as taxed on their estate. So this only affects the uber wealthy. But also, it included in this is an exemption from capital gains, which would mean that effectively estates could pass on to their heirs these estates without any tax for generation after generation, accumulating vast wealth because capital gains only comes into play when you actually sell an asset. So this is an extraordinary move towards an American aristocracy away from the meritocracy that the founding fathers envisioned for this country.
Yeah, so let me, I think I agree with you completely there, and let me put some of these things in some historical perspective. So first of all, if we just look at the year 2013, which is the year we have the best data, only 20 small farms or businesses actually had to pay the estate tax. So the people backing this initiative are trying to make it seem like small ma-and-pa firms, you know, hardworking people are the ones who are getting burdened by this. That is a tiny, tiny proportion of the people who are actually paying this tax. And by the way, those 20 small businesses or farms only had to pay, on average, 5% of the value of what was being transferred. So the argument that this is really protecting the small rich is just not true. And then going back further in history, if we go back to 1916, when this estate tax was first put in place, it was designed precisely because most of us make our income and get taxed on the basis of our salaries. But the legislatures at the time noticed that there were people who were making enormous amounts of money on their money. That is, nobody was paying them. It was just capital gains on their investments, their stocks, and everything else. So one of the ideas of the estate tax was for the first time to actually to tax that wealth before it got passed on to someone else, in this case, their children. And then finally, if we go back even further in history, all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, Madison, and others, the founding fathers that conservatives always like to hearken back to, they very deliberately passed laws to make sure that the United States did not have an aristocracy, a sort of caste of wealthy people at the top who passed their wealth on generation after generation and basically controlled the politics of the country. So they passed a number of legislations and bills at the time, including, by the way, the idea of funding education publicly. All of these ideas were basically to try to say that markets do not automatically themselves distribute opportunities and wealth in society. So we should do it as a matter of public policy, just to make sure that the gap between the very few wealthy and everyone else is not so huge.
Well, but this is actually anti-market. If you pass your wealth on to your heirs, there's no guarantee that your heirs, in fact, I don't know whether you know that many rich people, but I know a bunch of trust fund kids and they're complete cripples, you know. I don't think it's, you know, it's anecdotal. I'm not saying that all heirs don't measure up to the person who made the fortune, but more often than not, the person who made the fortune's kids are incredibly spoiled and not really up to the task. So this, to my mind, this would, you would end up with a, you know, an aristocracy of, you know, Paris Hiltons.
Well, exactly. And in fact, that was one of the burdens in European countries where you had generation after generation of aristocrats. And at some point, maybe someone incredibly talented, someone who, in a market sense, was able to get very rich, maybe they did do something very productive for society, created jobs or whatever. But once those riches got passed on to kids who were spoiled and had every life advantage to begin with in terms of school, in terms of networks, opportunities, many, many times the kids of these folks are not necessarily the people that we would want the most capital to be in the hands of. So just from a market efficiency point of view, when we put policies in place that automatically give an opportunity or an advantage to a certain group of people, that is, as you say, anti-market. It's anti-competitive. It is against the basic notion that people based on the merits ought to be able to rise up. So the obverse side of these Paris Hiltons and other sort of rich kids is all of the very, very talented people in the underclass who, because of the neighborhoods they live in, because of the violence in those neighborhoods, because of the low quality of schools, those very talented people who might contribute an enormous amount to society never get a chance. But meanwhile, the kids of the wealthy do. So when these transfers are occurring from parent to kids, there's a cost being paid by society. So quite apart from the question of whether those with the most resources ought to help fund other things in our society more than those least able to pay, you know, the conservatives and the Republicans, just on market grounds alone, ought to embrace an estate tax.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. So this, of course, is going to also deprive the U.S. Treasury of $270 billion over 10 years. So, I mean, again, you know, the same deficit hawks who say the sky is falling, we're in debt and all this stuff, are the ones that are gifting the 1% of the 1%. I mean, it's inescapably, this is also an issue of campaign finance, isn't it? I mean, this really shows you how the wealthy have bought our politics. Do you see anything on the horizon that's going to reverse that trend as the Koch brothers and the Sheldon Adelsons more and more buy our politics?
Well, I would say one thing that's happening is that the consciousness in the United States now of the role being played by a very small number of people who are empowered in this democracy by wealth, it's having an effect on people's perception of their democracy. I'll just give you a quick example. I teach a course at Northwestern called Oligarchs and Elites. And roughly 7 years ago, when I offered this course for the first time, it was relatively difficult to get a bunch of senior undergraduates in the seminar to buy the argument that there were problems with American democracy, and that there was a small group of people called oligarchs who were distorting the process in their favor. This year, this past fall, I taught the course again, and there were no students in the class who believed that there was much of anything democratic left about the United States. And I found myself in the position of sort of having to argue, well, yes, there are democratic elements still in the system. It matters. But the students were just, there's just been a sea change of perception. And that sea change of perception that there is something profoundly wrong and unjust about the way our system is working is spreading. And that is not good for American democracy. It's attacking the very legitimacy of the system. And so the trend is moving in that direction, and I believe that it's only going to get worse before it gets better. There's a point at which the decision makers in government are going to have to realize that serving a very small percentage of the population is unviable in the long run.
But when Republicans, like Representative Kevin Brady of Texas, says about the so-called repeal of the so-called death tax, it is at its heart an immoral tax, and this has been their mantra, that somehow this is deeply unfair, the idea that you tax dead people, which of course is not the case, but that's how they framed it. Does that resonate? I know that there's been propaganda over the years that's been effective to make people think that the government is the problem and paying taxes is extortion. And this guy, Ted Cruz, running for president, wants to eliminate the IRS. I don't know how he thinks the government can function, but some of these Tea Party people don't believe in government. And as I don't know whether you've been following the budgets, but last year the Republicans stripped money out of the budget for the IRS, and in the new budget they stripped even more money out. So they basically are on this weird jihad to attack the very nature of government itself. But then if you really look at the statistics, if everybody in this country paid their taxes as they're supposed to, we wouldn't have a deficit. We would have incredibly secure social programs. There'd be no problems with Medicare and Social Security, and we could actually move towards a social democracy, which we used to be from 1944 to 1977, until President Reagan came along and changed the entire landscape. And arguably, almost every president since Reagan has been an heir to Reaganism.
Yes. So, you know, there are many things going on here. One is that this is a almost 100-year-old battle against what are called transfers. That is, redistribution. Should the government, through welfare, and this goes back to the New Deal and the Great Depression, should the government, through programs, help other people in society who don't have a chance? That's by helping provide education, by helping provide health care, sometimes even the government just investing in roads and infrastructure just to create jobs that the market itself doesn't create. So there is a group of very, very wealthy people in the United States whose number one objective is not necessarily to fund all the costs of our broader society, but to make sure everybody else has to bear those costs. And so there's an uneven playing field in that battle over who's going to pay for taxes. And so the very rich don't like the idea that they get taxed and some of their money goes toward people they think are undeserving. They don't like what are called transfers. Now, there are two ways you can fight transfers. You can either try to get programs cut, which there is a constant battle to try to get various programs cut in the United States. But if you lose that battle, the other side of the battle is to squeeze the Treasury so tightly that there's no choice but to cut the programs. Or, and this is what the wealthy have been especially good at, push the tax burden down onto the middle class in particular so that they have a higher tax burden, and they, too, will want to get rid of taxes. And so the strategy has multiple dimensions to it, and it's very effective. And by the way, the estate tax itself is one of the areas in which the rich have been especially successful already. So if we go back to, like, 2000 or 2001, the estate tax exemption, that is how much you can transfer, that number you gave earlier, how much you can transfer without even being taxed at all, that threshold has gone up six times. So a 600% increase in how much you can transfer without being taxed, that's already a major victory. And now they're pushing to cross the finish line and say no tax whatsoever on this. And the one thing that listeners really need to understand is that there is an entire industry, something I call the wealth defense industry. It is a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States whose sole function is to work 24 hours a day, year round, to defend the interests of the wealthy. And this is lawyers, accountants, wealth management firms, lobbying firms, think tanks. The wealthy are investing their resources not in the infrastructure of the United States, but they're investing it in an entire multi-billion dollar industry whose sole job is to make sure the wealthy don't have to pay taxes and push the burden onto everyone else. And the reason you're finding a lot of Americans joining into this attack the government is the problem kind of ideology is because two things. The burden is increasing on those less able to pay, and the middle class knows that the wealthiest are getting away scot-free. So there's just anger and resentment about this, but they find allies among middle-class households, and frankly, the people who support this, who are not in the top, you know, two-tenths of 1% at the top, if you support it, you are just foolish and stupid. You're not informed. You're voting against your own interests. And if you want to do that, go ahead. But if you want a stronger, more vibrant United States, taxing the very rich is not a bad idea.
Well, we know about the mindset of the very wealthy from the leaked tape of Mitt Romney talking to wealthy backers down in Florida, where he talked about the 47% who are basically the takers, and you, my rich friends, are the makers. That is a pervasive mindset. But the wealthiest in this country seem to forget that during the halcyon days of the American dream, under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, a Republican, the wealthy paid 92% tax, and America dominated the world at that point. And the American economy at that point was the engine of the global economy. So, you know, it's really about progressive versus regressive taxes. And obviously, you know, the young people might well in this country vote for Rand Paul, who wants the most regressive of taxes, which is a value-added tax on everything you buy, and the rich don't get taxed at all. And if you want an example of a country without a government, go to Haiti, you know, where you have to pay for your education, even though you have no money. You have to pay for health care, even though you have no money. There's no government to speak of. I mean, it's insane. But unfortunately, not enough people make a case for how a progressive tax makes for a progressive and much more livable country.
Yes, and so we have a couple things going on. One is that the gap between the wealthiest Americans and the average household is now at historically high levels. That is, you know, the free market, one of the things it does is it does generate a lot of wealth, but it also concentrates that wealth. So a question society has to ask is, do we want to live in a community where millions upon millions of households live in horribly rotting neighborhoods under what are Haitian and third world conditions very often? Do we want to tolerate that kind of situation in the United States while other people are hived off in gated communities, never encounter any of these folks, never experience the violence, the degradation, the lack of human dignity? Is that the kind of society we want? And it's a public policy question. Historically, Americans have embraced the idea that creating opportunities for people and letting them make more of themselves, this is something we have always embraced, and it's always been a combination of the effort individuals make, but also resources that are made available. Anybody in Economics 101 knows that a person who has access to capital, a person who has access to resources, is vastly more likely to be able to catapult themselves upward than someone who has no resources at all to start with and has to try to somehow scrounge around. So do we want to create opportunities in our society rather than simply let the market determine what the outcome is going to be? And if we just let the market determine the outcome, this is going to be a very, very vicious society indeed.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe and the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore and the Philippines. He's the author of Oligarchy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about a bill stalled in the California legislature that would mandate the vaccination of school children. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Peter Katona, who is a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine and a professor of public health at UCLA. He has worked at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and has authored articles on medical informatics, medical education, influenza, polio, nutrition, bioterrorism, disasters, and the future of healthcare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Peter Katona.
Glad to be here.
And the bill before the California legislature to mandate the vaccination of children who attend public and private schools in California is stalled in the legislature between the Senate Health Committee and the Senate Education Committee after vocal opposition from the anti-vaxxer community, in many ways led by Bobby Kennedy Jr., who made an impassioned plea on the steps of the Capitol up in Sacramento, saying that forcing the vaccination of children was akin to a Holocaust. Do you have any, as a medical doctor, do you have any concept of what Bobby Kennedy Jr. might have been talking about?
Well, I should point out that Mr. Kennedy also took back those comments and apologized for them. No, they were completely inappropriate. There's absolutely no reason that a child should be vaccinated unless there is a medical reason for that exclusion. Having a personal exemption or having a religious exemption has no medical value and is very disruptive to society. You know, people have to understand that vaccination is not only good for the individual, but it also protects others in the community as well, particularly those that are immune compromised and can't get vaccinated. So this opposition to this bill I find to be very detrimental to the workings of a good society.
Well, at this point, though, just, you know, hyperbole aside, a lot of what was set up in Sacramento, in fact, there was a comparison made to Brown versus the Board of Education in terms of denying education to a minority. Of course, that doesn't quite gel because the African Americans were trying to opt into an education that whites were given. In this case, people want to opt out on a special exemption. So is there any practical way to set up separate schools for people with unconventional beliefs?
Well, it all depends if you have the best interests of society at stake. You know, there's absolutely no legitimate reason for denying vaccination for these reasons. The actual harmfulness of vaccination is almost zero, and that includes virtually all of these vaccinations that children get. So the actual risk from vaccinations, unlike what Mr. Kennedy said, is almost zero. And the benefits of vaccinating are so significant in terms of the health of the public at large that there's really no reason that I can see that would justify, you know, putting people in separate schools or anything like that. There's a difference between the education issue that came with the lawsuit that you mentioned and the health of the public, which is much, much different. And you're dealing with not only the health of an individual, but the health of the public in general. And we saw from what happened recently how people not getting vaccinated are basically spreading a particular disease from one state to other states as it spreads across the country.
Well, that's the sort of peculiar part of it, though, Dr. Peter Katona, that it's as though these parents, the so-called anti-vaxxers, want it both ways. And this is why it stalled in the Education Committee of the California Senate. They're saying, you know, we want to send our kids to public schools, but we don't want to vaccinate them. But as my understanding is the majority of parents who vaccinate their kids are now aware that unvaccinated kids put their kids at risk. So it really is a case about minority beliefs versus majority rights, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, the children that are unvaccinated have posed a risk for a long time. This is not anything new. They've just come to realize it now. And it's interesting that these higher vaccination areas tend to be the more affluent areas, not necessarily the poor areas. It's these affluent mothers that seem to get it in their heads that vaccination is unnecessary or is particularly harmful, which is completely untrue.
So what explains anti-intellectualism or anti-science amongst the educated? That's a sort of, isn't that a paradox?
I don't know if it's a paradox. I mean, maybe it's a question of we know better. You know, there's the Dr. Wakefield influence where he published a paper linking autism to vaccinations, a study that has been completely disproven. He's actually lost his medical license. They retracted the study from the Lancet. But people still continue to think that there's some conspiracy and that there's really some truth in the fact that there are these associations and there are these harmful effects of vaccines. So people seem to think that they know better than science and they don't trust us. And there's also some that feel that we shouldn't have any regulations except the absolutely necessary ones because it's a government intrusion into our lives. But when it comes to the health of the community, there's more at stake than whether somebody has individual choice or not. I mean, I should point out also, there's really only two other states that have laws banning all but health reasons for not vaccinating. We would actually be the third, although there's some other states that I think have it pending now. So we're, you know, on the forefront of this to be able to kind of do this in a way that I think is correct.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Cotone, who's a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine and a professor of public health at UCLA. He has worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and has authored articles on medical informatics, medical education, influenza, polio, nutrition, bioterrorism, disasters, and the future of healthcare. So in terms of the bill being stalled, and it's obviously, I think it has a lot to do with the passion and the beliefs of these people who demonstrated this, the so-called anti-vaxxers. They seem to have, although it passed out of the Senate Health Committee, now the Senate Education Committee is holding it up, and there's a vote on Wednesday. What's your sense of in terms of lobbying versus counter-lobbying? I mean, if this is a minority view, yet this vocal minority showed up, what does it require? Does it require the majority to show up, or is there a way that common sense can prevail here?
Well, you know, we're reaching a point in society where a very small number of people with a very small minority view can have an influence that's out of proportion to their numbers. You know, you look at any act of terrorism, it's a very small number that actually do a lot of harm. And here again, I mean, by all accounts, this is a very small minority that espouses the view that we should have the right not to vaccinate our children. But it is a minority. And, you know, the committee has to do what it thinks is correct. But if they let a small minority dictate the view, then it would not be a good way for our government to show that it's functioning effectively.
So, you know, at this point, Senator Lonnie Hancock on the Education Committee said, if I'm reading the bill correctly, there's nothing I can do if you choose not to vaccinate your child except homeschool and then only with your own children. And that's the sort of, that's where it stalled here, you know, on the idea that how do you justify the public purpose of public safety and the right for everyone to have access to an education? It seems pretty extraordinary that, again, people want their kids to get a public education, but they don't seem to be aware that unvaccinated children are putting the rest of their classmates at risk. And it seems to be pretty clear that the rights of the majority should trump the beliefs of the minority.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, that's the way it works. I mean, the alternative is to mandate vaccination for every kid, and I don't think our society is willing to do that. But we do have an obligation to keep our society healthy, and the way we've elected to do that is to basically tell parents that if they want their kids to go to public school, they have to show evidence of vaccination.
So at this point, are you aware of anybody that's sort of weighing in on this issue? If Bobby Kennedy, and you mentioned that he's apologized for his remarks, but he certainly is a fairly prominent public figure. If he's been leading the charge with the anti-vaxxers, is there anybody that's leading the charge in the opposite direction? Because it sounds like the legislature up in Sacramento are wavering.
I don't know officially which entity has, but I can tell you that every public health authority in this country is going to be in favor of a bill like this. Anybody who is actually has any knowledge or any involvement in public health is going to tell you that a bill like this will be a positive thing for society.
So at this point, I guess we have to wait for Wednesday then. And it's a little bit odd, I must say, that we have come to this, particularly after all of the publicity, starting with the outbreak of measles at Disneyland. I mean, you would think that the idea that children, young children, could actually die from these diseases that were all but eradicated because people, even educated people from affluent communities, have adopted this belief system.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole concept that science is not necessarily the end-all, and that we don't have to be careful about believing what science tells us because there's possible conspiracies against us, or maybe the science is wrong. But the evidence for vaccination goes back a long time and is exceedingly positive. You know, there are 1 out of 100,000 cases of measles vaccine that will give complications. That's true. But the benefit so far outweighs that we don't consider that particularly important.
Well, Dr. Peter Katona, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Katona, who's a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine and professor of public health at UCLA. He has worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and has authored articles on medical informatics, medical education, influenza, polio, nutrition, bioterrorism, disasters, and the future of healthcare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.